Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome into Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, our weekly chance to catch up with the world of technology from a blindness or low vision perspective. I'm your host, Dave Williams. Fantastic to be with you once again. Don't forget, of course, Tech Talk, it's our programme, and we're really keen to hear from you. We'd love to know what you think. Have you got a comment or a question or an experience that you would like to share? Tech tips, they're also welcome. You can write into techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Good old-fashioned emails or voice notes, all very welcome. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, we'll be getting some advice about staying safe online. We will be comparing some of the most popular smart speakers on the market, and Callum Stoneman has been finding out about the latest Good Maps trial with Transport for Greater Manchester. That's all to come this time on Tech Talk. But firstly, welcome in to our co-hosts, Hubert Bavalkovich, Callum Stoneman, Jackie Brown and Natalie Kern. Fantastic. We've got a full house this week. Let's pop round to each of you and find out what's grabbing your attention in the world of technology. Hubert, what's new with you?
It's a ChatGPT project, a brand new feature to ChatGPT subscribers, which allows you to do a bit of a folder-like structure to your conversations, so you can group uploads, web searches and instructions into specific discussion projects. So maybe, you know, you've got like some work-related conversations, if you're allowed to use ChatGPT at work, that is, or you can have conversations regarding specific topics and you can group them into projects, which I find quite interesting. It's a new feature, so I think there's still a little bit to go, but I do like how you can group things based on topic and it can refer to these things when you're discussing topics relating to the project you have found, which is quite interesting.
Okay, I'd be curious to know how people are using that in the real world. You know, some examples would be fantastic to hear. Let us know. Callum, let's come to you next.
Well, I want to mention another podcast, actually, because there's a podcast called 20,000 Hertz, which it's a show all about sound, really, and sound design. And I don't listen to it that often, to be honest, but it's good. I've caught a couple of them. And the latest one, or the latest at the time of recording, they've done an episode on kind of the history of accessibility at Apple, and it's talking about how accessibility at Apple came about way back in kind of the early 80s and how it's evolved, and in the case of voiceover, how the voices have got better. So, you know, at first you had this really, really robotic voice. It gives you you hear a demo, actually, a presentation from I think it's the mid 80s, where the first time the Mac speaks, and it's this really if you've ever heard Fred, it's even more robotic.
He's in there, isn't he? He's still in there in some Apple devices.
Still there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's even more robotic than that. But of course, the applause that it gets and the cheer in that event, because obviously no one's heard a computer speak before. And then you hear how, you know, that evolved. And then a few years later, we got Alex and the weird kind of breathing noise that he does. But it's... sorry, I know people like Alex, but I just find it creepy. I've got to be honest. But it's an interesting... I think if you follow this world, then there's probably not much in there that you didn't already know. But it's just interesting hearing those stories and actually hearing how it evolved, especially because a lot of it was before my time. And nowadays, they're really kind of blurring the lines between accessibility and mainstream. You know, for example, like the hearing features in the AirPods. Brilliant for people with hearing impairments, but also just everyone. You know, everyone uses the... Everyone can make use of the noise cancelling or the transparency or the adaptive modes. So it's an interesting episode. And this isn't an accessibility podcast. It's a mainstream podcast. But it's the best explanation, mainstream explanation, of some of these features that I've heard in a long time. So it's a good listen.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I'm quite fond of some of those you know, earlier voice models, because they're just very consistent and reliable and predictable, and you kind of know how they're going to behave. Is that true for you, Jackie?
Yeah, because I started my journey with synthetic speech in the 80s. So the first thing that I ever came across was the Braid synthesizer, this metal box with a couple of knobs on the front and a speaker. And you connected that to the BBC master via the RS232 port. Remember that? And it was really quirky. And then I moved on to Eureka with her, "Please press any key to retrieve." She was Australian. She was really, really quirky.
Nice.
I've never met any Australians that sounded like the Eureka, though. That's
No.
but yeah, was it the Mimic? That
Yeah,
was one of the synthesizers
that
with the BBC.
followed the
Yeah.
Braid. That's the one I
Yeah.
had after the
Mm.
Braid on the BBC. And then, of course, it was the Howl speech synthesizer, the bigger one,
Hello.
the Apollo. Yeah, the Apollo one, and then the Apollo two. And then, of course, talking teletext, which was made by Portset, which was my favorite device probably of all time, at that point. And it had the Apollo one synthesizer as well in it. So there were some really quirky guys and gals about.
Not to mention Deck Talk as well. We've got a bit distracted in the history of text-to-speech
Indeed.
devices. Have you got anything new, Jackie? Is anything
Yeah.
grabbing your attention just now?
Yeah. I've been playing with an app this week. It's called MV. So it's spelt EMVI. And when you go into it, you can pay a subscription like a lot of these. It does have AI in it. But it's you can go in and sign in as a guest as well. And there are four main features. One of them is to ask it questions. So you double tap to ask a question, you double tap to stop it listening. But you need to swipe with three fingers across the screen to get to each of these features. One of them is a barcode scanner, but I have to say it is really good. We went into the cupboards in the kitchen this week and were playing with it, and it was really good. It very, very quick at getting the barcode off your product and telling you what it was and the ingredients. There's also a document scanner, and as I say, you've got the asking it questions and things as well. The only thing for me is you've just got to get the finger gestures correct. The three finger swipe across the middle of the screen, sometimes that catches me out for whatever reason. I'm not sure why, but it just does. It's available on iOS and Android, and it works pretty well because Martin has it on his Pixel, and it works pretty well for him as well. In fact, it was he who told me about it, and I tried it on my iPhone. So give that a go. As I say, you can pay a subscription. I think it's about £4 or something a month, but you can go into it as a guest. And it took me just a little while to get used to the, as I say, the swiping, but once you get the hang of it is worth having.
Okay, Envy. How are you spelling that again, Jackie?
EMVI, so that's Echo Mike Victory Information,
India.
whatever.
Oh,
Yeah.
there you go. Okay, but M for
Yeah.
Mike. Okay, fantastic. Natalie, thank you for waiting. What have you got?
I that's all right too. I've not got anything particularly exciting. I was laughing at some of that chat there. The thing that always got me was when I discovered the eloquence range of voices on the Braille notes, the HumanWare Braille notes. And they had a child one, which I just thought was creepy.
Was it Kit the Kid?
I don't remember it having a name. There was just eloquence. You had like eloquence grandma and eloquence child, and I just thought, I'm going to stick with the synthetic voice. I think I prefer that. But no, the only thing that's caught my attention this week is more of an accessibility bug as opposed to something positive, but not a big one. So on my personal laptop, I was getting an error message saying that my Braille display wasn't connecting properly. And to rerun JAWS 2021. And I thought, hang on a minute, I'm on 2022. And I found that I had both installed, but apparently JAWS 21's a bit more aggressive than 22. So even if you have them both installed and try to disable 21, like just in the settings, say, don't turn on for this user, don't come on the logon screen, that kind of thing. If you either go into 2022, it will sort of override the settings and be like, no, I'm in charge. So I'm psyching myself up to go into the settings and apps and uninstall 2021. But I want to do that when I've got my wits about me so that I don't accidentally uninstall them both and cause myself a real problem.
Well, I'm sure the Jaws dealer in the UK, which is Sight and Sound, can offer technical support with that and any other Jaws-related issues. So let us know how you get on. But for now, Hubert, Callum, Jackie, Natalie, thank you so much. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk. Hubert recently went along to an event all about staying safe when you're blind or partially sighted, and he spoke with AbilityNet about staying safe online.
You are listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and we are here at SafeCon 25, looking at how to keep yourself safe if you're blind and partially sighted. Joining me now is digital skills trainer from AbilityNet, Steve Mercer. Steve, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about AbilityNet and what you do?
AbilityNet's a charity. We've been working for about 25 years, a little bit more now, I think. And most of what we do is supporting people with disabilities to use technology, to make technology accessible to people. So we work with large organisations. Well, actually, we work with all sorts of organisations to help them make their technology more accessible. So websites, any sort of apps, whatever technology they're creating. And we also have a project in which we support people to solve any particular technical problems they have. So if they're struggling with connecting to the internet, for instance, if they're struggling with using WhatsApp, perhaps, we have a free service where people can phone us up and get sort of some help with that.
What are some of the common issues that could be coming up with safety online these days?
I think there are two main things to be aware of, scams and viruses. And really, the way we keep ourselves safe from both of those is largely the same. When we get an email or when we get a message, very often it will ask us to click on a link. And the most common cause of getting a virus and also of putting ourselves at being at risk of scammed, of putting ourselves at risk of being scammed, is clicking on a link that is malicious, so sent by a malicious actor. If we avoid clicking on those links, if we avoid clicking on links and messages that are sent to us, we're going to keep ourselves safe more often than not. In fact, not more often than not. It's very, very difficult to get a virus without clicking on a link. So clicking on a link from a message is the key thing. In terms of being scammed, the problem with digital technology is that, I mean, scams have been around for ages, right? They've been around for thousands of years. Thousands of years ago, people were adding water to wine and selling it, and people were adding breadcrumbs to sawdust to bread to make to make the bread go further. So scams aren't new. The challenge nowadays is that it's very easy to pretend to be somebody else online. The main thing we really need to do to keep ourselves safe is to be suspicious of messages that we're not expecting. And even if we get a message from somebody we are expecting a message from, if it's asking for money or asking for information, then there's a chance that that message isn't genuine. And the way to protect ourselves from that is, if there's any doubt in our mind at all, to check with the person that sent the message, but using a different channel, so using a different type of communication. So if you get a message or text message from somebody and it sounds like it's somebody you know, if the message says dear dad or dear mum, if it's asking for money or if it's asking for anything that sounds a little bit off, then check with that person, but not by replying to the text, by contacting them in a different method. And the reason for that is, if somebody has had their phone, their device compromised, they could send out a text message or a message from that phone. So if you reply to the message, you're simply replying to the bad actor, the malicious actor.
One of the key aspects of modern security is, of course, passwords. One of the common issues is, obviously, we are all advised to have a different password for every website we use. But it's obviously a tricky part to remember all these passwords. So that's where password managers come in. what would be your advice on passwords these days?
Passwords are virtually impossible to remember, aren't they? Everybody struggles to remember more than three or four passwords. I mean, I have literally hundreds, and nobody can remember all of those passwords. We're supposed to use different passwords for all the services we use. And the reason for that is if one is compromised, if you use the same password for all your different services, then those services are all vulnerable. So the advice is certainly to use different and complicated passwords and unique passwords for all of the sites, all of the apps, all of the services you use. That's where password managers come in. Most devices nowadays, most modern devices will have a password manager built in. If you feel technically competent to use those password managers, then they're a really, really good idea. So if you have an iPhone, it will come with a password manager called Keychain. If you use an Android phone, that will come with a password manager called Google Password Manager. And those are as secure as Google or Apple's security is. And so I think we can assume that they are reasonably secure. The challenge you have is that the password manager itself needs a password, and that can't be stored on the password manager. So you have to have that remembered, and it has to be as secure as possible, because if that's a single point of failure, if that password is compromised, then you're going to lose all your passwords. So I would certainly advise that if you feel comfortable, use a password manager and use as complicated and secure a password as you can.
And if people would like to get more advice and support on security or any other tech related issues, how can they contact AbilityNet or find out more about what you do?
Okay, so you can phone. We've got a low-call number, a low-cost number, which is 0300 180 0028.
And do you have a website people can go to get more information about AbilityNet?
Of course. We've got the website AbilityNet, and I'll give you the address now. It's abilitynet.org.uk.
Fantastic. Steve Mercer from AbilityNet, thank you very much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Now, one of the topics that comes up quite regularly on Tech Talk is indoor navigation. And you can't really think of indoor navigation without thinking about Good Maps. The latest trial that they're running is in several locations across the Greater Manchester B network, and I'm here at Shute Hill Interchange to give some feedback on the trial. I'm joined by Graham Banks, who's the Customer Travel Information Manager for Transport for Greater Manchester, and regular on the show, Neil Barnfather, CCO and Good Maps. Thanks for joining us both. Graham, do you want to just tell us a bit about the Good Maps trial? So how did it come about, and what's going on basically? What sort of Where can people try it out?
Yeah, of course. So Metrolink got in touch with us, and it was Jess in our partnerships and engagement team, and told me about this new feature, a new app called Good Maps. Or maybe not so new, but new to us in any case. And I was very interested straight away, because accessibility is a big part of what we do at Transport for Greater Manchester, and to improve travel information for everyone. So initially we met with Neil at Manchester Airport, who had already been I think a partner, Neil, in the journey so far, and we did a bit of user testing. We downloaded the app and used it ourselves, and had a lovely coffee afterwards and a chat, and we really wanted to explore this further to see how we could use Good Maps for our customers and for Metrolink's customers.
What sort of locations is available for, if people want to try it out, if people want to make use of it, what's the kind of areas that people can do that in?
So we've got, at the moment, we're piloting several locations in Greater Manchester, and we're really keen to use it across Greater Manchester, not focus on the city centre, because that's what tends to happen. So we've got Good Maps available at Bolton Interchange and Rail Station, Shute Hill in the city centre, that includes the bus station and the Metrolink stop, Victoria Station, at the airport, but also at Piccadilly Station as well. So we've got several different locations. I did mention there about not just being in the city centre. We're aware that most of them are, but we have got Bolton, like I said.
Yeah, and the airport is an interesting one, because that is, of course, a place where there can be issues with the assistance. So does that get you to
you know, what sort of places are mapped there? Could someone go right from check-in straight to their boarding gate independently if they wanted to?
They can literally use the interchange, the full interchange, the railway station, the Metrolink station, the bus station, and they can make their way to the tunnel, which then leads you onto the boarding gates and them kind of information. But we are keen to work with, obviously, Manchester Airport and other partners to have that full end-to-end experience.
And this is one of the interesting things about this particular trial, is that it's across multiple networks, I guess, isn't it? Because you can go from, in one journey, you can go from, say, you can get off the bus, and then if you've got a connection tram or a connection train, it covers, you know, goes all transport types across the area.
It does. That was a timely announcement. Yeah, that's exactly what we wanted to try on these different locations. So obviously the B networks now are multimodal, interchangeable transport option, and that's exactly what we want to do. So a customer can go from a bus to a tram or rail to a bus. That's exactly what we want to do, and make it as easy and as accessible as possible.
And Neil, from your point of view, what is some of the feedback that you've received? Because I'm guessing from your perspective, like for days like this, the feedback that you get, obviously there's some stuff that's specific to locations, you know, specific locations, but I'm guessing there's also, you can also get a lot of feedback about the app and the service in general that you can work with.
Absolutely. I think that the end user feedback is pivotal to us. We are a community first product and solution, and what our end users tell us and their experiences, particularly upon the first time of using their inaugural journey, if you will, is pivotal. We need to know that people can download the app independently and have their first journey successfully. So being able to attend here today and see people using and interacting with the app for the first time and having that experience, it's incredibly valuable to us. But it also is very humbling, to be honest, to see people actually having that experience, and as well as the learning opportunity, just hearing people having those successes and sort of really, you know, being able to say, you know, it worked, I got there. And, you know, you can hear it in their voices, that affirmative positivity of like, well, hang on, but I could use it here. But then the realization that, well, I also know you go into Victoria or Piccadilly and so forth, that really is a fantastic moment to observe people using it and having that realization.
I guess this is to kind of both of you, really, whoever wants to answer this. But one of the things that I picked up on was the tram stops here at Shrews Hill at the minute are closed because there's some engineering works going on, I believe. And Grub Maps, for me, took me to the tram stop, but it didn't give me any info that actually, you know, there were no services running. Is that sort of something that can be implemented?
Yes, it can. Yeah, it's a really good call. So there are several options and tools available in the product where points of interest can either have tags to indicate they're closed or that they're not available. So they can either be hidden from the map. That can, in a plain location like this, be confusing, because obviously if you're expecting a tram stop A to be available in the map and you can't find it, you may think that there's something wrong with what we're doing. So we would tend to encourage operators to change the label to say currently closed or words to that effect. That way the person knows it's there but is aware it's closed. And of course, you can view a location before you get there. So obviously if you were sort of thinking to yourself today, you're going to nip out, you're going to, you know, go and have a look. Part of that exercise might be to check the points of interest in the location in advance. And we very much encourage operators to make sure that they're managing those maps, keeping them up to date. It's often a little bit more tricky in a trial, because finding a dedicated owner of that project isn't always as streamlined as it becomes once it becomes a permanent project. But I'm quite certain that, you know, as the project establishes itself, we'll find that, you know, there's a process in place to ensure that sort of fee is catered for.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Graham, you mentioned this is a pilot, these locations. So what's, can you give any info on what's next for this at this stage?
Yeah, so initially it's a 3-month pilot, looking at all the stations and interchanges that we picked up on. At the end of the 3 months, and including today, we're taking a lot of user research, looking at all the feedback that's been coming through. We've got an ongoing survey and getting customers' views on what's good, what they'd like to see improved. All that kind of feedback feeds into our plan of what we're going to do in the future. And we'll be looking at the data as well that comes through from Neil and the team, and what people are using it for, what
Where are people searching for? It's really insightful, actually. I've had a look at some of the data so far, and you can see the journeys that customers are trying to make, whether it's a Platform 14, which is a challenging platform at Manchester Piccadilly, as everyone knows, or accessible toilets. So it's really interesting to see what kind of journeys people make. And then we'll be taking all that information and we'll be discussing with Neil and the team at the pilot and discussing next steps then, really.
Okay, so just before we wrap up, just give us those locations again where if you're in the Northwest, if you're in the Greater Manchester area, where people can go and give Good Maps a try.
Yeah, so the locations are Bolton Interchange and Rail Station, Manchester Airport, Piccadilly Station, Shute Hill Station and Metrolink in the city centre, and Manchester Victoria. And I must add as well, with Manchester Victoria, you can actually also access the arena with Good Maps.
Oh, okay.
So you can actually go from the tram or from the train all the way to the concert if you so want.
Very nice. I like that. And if people want to give feedback, how can they do that? How can they get in touch?
Please give your feedback. There's a TFGM survey that's currently live. It will be live for the duration of the pilot.
And obviously, support of goodmaps.com. If you make sure you include the venue that you're trialing at, the device is always really helpful, what type of phone you've used. And then feedback, whether it's, particular, difficulties you've had or just an experience that we love to obviously hear, anything that's sort of like, the positive angles and so forth. Because ultimately, though, we need to hear all of it to know what's working well for people and what they need to perhaps feedback to help us evolve the product.
Okay, fantastic. Well, Graham Banks and Neil Baumfowder, thanks a lot.
Cheers, Colin. Thank you.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
We've had an email from Vaughan, who writes in to extol the virtues of the Meta Ray-Bans. Vaughan writes, after a 30-year gap due to Stargardt's, I'm now able to just pick up an item and read it. I'm reading every bit of print I come across. Doesn't always do that by default, though, does it, folks? Sometimes you've got to ask...
No.
Well, what have you got to do, Jackie?
Well, you have to ask the Meta AI bot, if you like, to read something. And this has been a massive bone of contention in the UK, because not everybody is getting the AI features of the glasses. And it's kind of hit or miss whether you do. I think in that sense, Meta has made a bit of a hash of the rollout, because some people get it. Some people found using a VPN and going from a different country to use it. And others just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen for me anymore either. So it is strange.
I found that when I did have the AI features for a brief period of time, it would read some of the text. Most of the time it tried to, if I held up a document or I held up a product, it would just try and summarize it. So it might say, if I said read this, it might say, you're looking at a menu for Starbucks or whatever. And then you had to really kind of interrogate it to eventually get, if you then said, what are the cakes? It would then say, this section includes things like, and just give you a couple, but it wouldn't go into detail of like each item and the price and the allergens and all that kind of stuff. So you could do it, but it would take a good couple of minutes in my experience to actually get it to do that. But other people, particularly in America, where the AI is really developing, I don't know where you are in the world, Vaughan, but in the US, a lot of people have had a bit more success with that, so I hear.
Well, I might be able to give you a clue, Callum, because Vaughan also writes, I've even used them to translate Welsh text into English.
Oh, interesting.
That's got to be a good use case. You're not entirely convinced, Natalie.
No, I'm not. It's a bit of a relief, actually, to hear some of our colleagues here on TikTok saying some of the concerns or difficulties they've had. Because all I've heard is people saying how brilliant they are and how they've transformed their lives. And I have to say, I find seeing AI so much quicker and easier and less clunky. I don't need to say, hi, take a picture, read this, tell me that. do this and wait for it to catch on. Whereas with seeing AI, I open the app, wave my phone about, and get the information I need. And it's, I find it just much quicker and much easier. And that's also when the AI works, as I think it was Jackie was just mentioning there. I've had difficulties with the AI not working and the app disconnecting from my phone. It's all just been quite frustrating and not quite the revolution that other people seem to be experiencing. So it's a bit of a relief to hear that I'm maybe not totally alone in that.
Well, they're working well for Vaughan, and we're glad to hear it. But as you say, Natalie, it's important that we represent a range of views. So if your experience has varied, if you know, you're hearing everybody waxing lyrical about a thing and it's not working well for you, let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. You're with RNIB Connect Radio at CSUN 2025, and I'm with Alan Decker, who is an accessibility specialist with Solar Grove, who make the Envoy Connect, which is a highly portable, high quality, lightweight audiobook player that will soon be available from RNIB. But Alan, the reason I've come to talk with you is that you're also showing your next generation device. Why don't you tell listeners all about that?
Yes, well, thank you. So this is called the Vine C2 Recorder. So it is our first easy to use recording device that has a talking menu. So a user can record appointments, contact information, notes easily with the speaking menu to guide them through the recorder. So I'll just turn this on real quick. So it announced that the recorder was on.
Nice British English female voice there as well, Alan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we can actually change folders easily. So we can press the next folder over, contacts, appointments. So if we wanted to record an appointment, we just simply tap the record button. So it announced recording has started. So it's recording. When you're finished, you tap record again. The recording has ended, and it has gone to play pause, so we can tap play to preview our recording.
So it announced recording has started.
So I'll just pause that. So you can record like we did using the external microphone. You can also record through earbuds with a line-in microphone as well. For a more private recording.
I'm delighted that you're developing this product. We're often at RNIB asked for a very easy to use, high quality voice recorder, and it sounds like this might be that solution.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
And so what we're hearing there, of course, is the internal speaker, which is competing with a lot of background noise here at the exhibition. Presumably you can plug headphones in there as well.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. And just remind listeners about the charging and battery and how that all works.
Yeah, so there's a couple ways to charge it. So this model has the new Type-C connector. So you can connect this to power to charge quickly. It takes about an hour and 30 minutes to have a full charge. There's also a built-in solar panel on the back. So you can place this in a well-lit area. And with each hour of sunlight that it receives, it gets about 2 hours of charge time. And the player can hold up to about 20 to 25 hours of charge capacity.
Fantastic. And then what about those recordings then? How much can you record on there?
Yeah, so it has an 8 GB internal recording. The files are recorded in an Opus format. So we can hold thousands of hours of audio recordings on the internal. And there's also a micro SD port so that can expand up to 128 gigabytes.
And are you able to offload those recordings to another device if you wanted to copy them onto a computer or something else?
Yes, you can. So you can connect this with the Type-C connector to your PC. It will show up like you plugged in a flash drive, so you can easily pull out those recordings from each of the different folders. You can also connect it to the Type-C connector to load music or books as well. So very similar to the Envoy Connect, that is the book reader model only, this device has that same internal feature, so you can play books, music, podcast, anything that is in audio.
And not that I'm suggesting anyone try this, but the Solar Grove devices are quite rugged, really. You can, you know, drop them, and because they're so lightweight, they're probably going to be okay.
Absolutely. That is one of the features of Solar Grove is its durability. So it's shockproof, it's weather resistant, it's resistant to extreme heat, extreme cold. So it's going to handle any environment.
What do you expect to be the timeline on this? Is this available now, or is this something for the future?
So it launched in November. So we are moving now. We've signed up several distributors in the U.S., and we're looking forward to working with more, including RNIB.
Excellent. And of course, the key thing about your devices is that they are very tactile. The buttons have got a very distinctive shapes so that you can find and feel them by touch. They've got a little bit of travel there as well when you press them, which gives you confidence as a user. And of course, they are designed to be fully accessible, so all those menu prompts are spoken as well.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things we have spent a lot of time on, is passing out earlier models for feedback, because we wanted to make the tactile keypad universal. So somebody in the US, somebody in the UK, somebody in the Middle East can easily identify the buttons, and it's not language specific, so very, very tactile.
Brilliant. Well, Alan, I really appreciate you taking time out to speak with us today. Anyone interested to learn more about products from Solar Grove, how do we find your website?
Yeah, you just go to sgrove.com. It's just sgrove.com.
Excellent. Alan Decker, Accessibility Specialist with Solar Grove. Thank you so much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
All right, thank you.
Time now on Tech Talk to talk smart speakers. Yes, very much a topic covered plenty of times, but we want to talk about them more in general. What are they, and what exactly is there in the smart speakers market? To talk to me about it, I've got accessibility consultant Elliot Stonehill back with me. Elliot, thank you for joining us.
No problem, Hubert.
So for people that don't know, or maybe just haven't yet jumped onto the smart speakers bandwagon, what are smart speakers?
Well, so smart speakers really is just like a speaker that's got an inbuilt voice assistant. So Amazon have got their own, Google have got their own. And then you can also buy sort of third-party speakers such as Sonos or Bose that will have like the Amazon assistant or the Google assistant built in. And really, it's just sort of very useful because you can ask your speaker to play a specific radio station or a specific song. As long as you've got the music subscription to Spotify or Apple Music. And then you can also ask it things, obviously, like the time, the weather. I mean, we find it very useful here, particularly when we're cooking, to set timers and things like that. So there's lots of different things you can do. With the Amazon speaker, there's various different skills as well on there, which are a little bit hit and miss. But really, since they came in, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, maybe now, maybe a little bit less. I mean, we've got one in every room, so we use them multiple times a day and do find them extremely useful.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of smart speaker options there, you know, Google, Amazon, third parties. Even Apple have sort of their own one as well with the HomePod. What I always wonder is, when you have so many options on the table, how do you differentiate between them? So, you know, what are some of the comparisons? Is there some things that one speaker does better than the other sort of thing?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're extremely in the Apple ecosystem, so you've got Apple Music subscription, and you've got an iPhone and things like that, then the HomePod can be great, because then it can sort of obviously play your Apple Music, it can read out your iMessages and stuff like that. But apart from that, obviously it has got Siri in it, which is very hit and miss. To me, it's probably worse than Amazon and Google in terms of sort of answering questions and stuff like that. But I think they all do have their sort of benefits and the downsides, really. I mean, I'm sort of quite fortunate here. Like, I'm on my desk in my office, I've sort of got one of each. And sort of depending what question I might ask, I'll sort of ask a different one. For example, for Google, I find that quite good if I want to ask, I don't know, a cooking time for something like that. I don't know, a Chicago Town pizza or something like that. I find I get a much more accurate answer from Google if I ask that question than I do, say, Amazon or the HomePod.
Yeah, I found that with the Google Home speakers, or Google Nest, as they're now, I believe, called. You know, you always, I found it easier to ask questions and get research things, when as with the Amazon ones, they're kind of good for the skill point of view, where you can have different skills doing different things.
The Amazon ones I tend to use mainly really for sort of radio and timers and things like that. One thing I probably forgot to mention earlier, obviously, like you say, they all do their own speakers, Amazon and Google, and then you get the third party. If you're using a third party speaker, such as, I don't know, Sonos or Bose, you don't necessarily get all the functionality that you might do from Amazon's own speakers, the Echoes. There are certain features like cooling and drop-in and stuff like that, which aren't available on those third-party speakers.
You said yourself you've got quite a few within your house. Do you ever have a preference with which smart speaker you use more, or is it kind of dependent on the situation for you?
Well, again, it's dependent, and it depends really what you sort of prefer to have. I mean, if you really want really good audio quality for music and stuff like that, then I would sort of go down the Sonos route, although that is obviously sort of more expensive. If you're not so fussed about audio quality, really an Echo Dot, which you can normally get, I don't know, say £30 really sometimes when it's on sale. That is still very good quality, I think, for the size of the device. And I would definitely sort of recommend that for sort of anyone who wants to sort of maybe hasn't got a smart speaker at the moment. I would go sort of the Echo Dot route, sort of get one of those and see how you get on.
How secure do you find smart speakers? I know a lot of people find them a bit uncomfortable because they're worried, you know, where are they listening all the time or not? You know, what would you say to people who might be worried about the security side of these sorts of devices?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they are always listening because they've obviously got to pick up the wake word. But companies are doing a lot more now, I think, on privacy and stuff like that. So some information is only stored like locally rather than going to the cloud. A lot of them do have the option on the speaker to sort of mute the mic. So if you do, I don't know, want to turn it off for a few hours, or, you know, you don't want it on overnight in the bedroom or whatever, there are normally those options there. But again, it's down to sort of personal choice, really. For me, the sort of the benefits of having them on all the time sort of outweigh any sort of privacy concerns I might have. But obviously, I couldn't sort of speak for everyone on that.
Yeah, I'm the same. I tend to have them on all the time because you never know when you might want to ask the time or ask a question. And the whole muting the mic sometimes takes away the convenience of just using your voice. And speaking of using your voice, I mean, when we look at accessibility of these devices, technically, it's accessibility dreamland because all you have to do is use your voice. How do you find accessibility of smart speakers in general? Do you find it good? And have you had any accessibility challenges?
Yeah, I do find them pretty good. Most are sort of easy to upset. I mean, I'm sort of big into the Apple ecosystem, so I'll tend to sort of set them up with the iOS app. And the apps can be a little bit hit and miss. I actually prefer the Google Home app to the Amazon A-Lady app, shall we say. And then obviously once it's all set up and everything, because they haven't got a screen, you're not asked to sort of look at anything. Obviously, Amazon do smart speakers with a screen, and I have had those in the past. And although they have got Amazon sort of voice view built into them, which is a screen reader, I just don't tend to find them quite as good, really, because voice view will often be sort of talking over what's on the screen. So you'll get sort of two speaking things going off at once. And if you don't have voice view on, and you ask the speaker something, it will often say the information's on the screen for you to read. So I probably wouldn't recommend one with a screen necessarily. Although, again, sort of contradicting myself, they do have some useful features. I know they do, some of them have a sort of look feature. So you can sort of hold up something to the camera and ask sort of what that is. So again, it probably depends what you're looking for.
Have you used one of these kind of show and tell features with smart speakers? Because I've heard very mixed reviews about their reliability. Have you given them a go?
I have to be honest, I did probably, but not for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. So it's probably sort of come on a long way since I had one, my own Echo Show 8 3 or 4 years ago. Really now I tend to just use or Be My Eyes or Seeing AI on my phone.
Now, I remember during our last chat when we talked about accessible televisions, you've said you've done a bit of work on the accessibility testing in that area. Have you done any work regarding smart speakers?
I've done a little bit of work with Sonos. Obviously, they had a lot of issues with their app when it was updated last May. And since then, I've been sort of working with them a little bit on making that more accessible again. And talking to them sort of generally about the accessibility of their speakers.
And what's been the result of that? Has the app become more accessible since?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I mean, I don't want to claim that's just because of me. I'm sure there's been lots of people working them, but it is good seeing a company engage at least. I mean, it was sort of quite controversial at the time, not just for blind and partially sighted people, but for people generally when they sort of changed the app last May. But since then, I have to give them credit. They have sort of made big strides forward. It's not perfect, but what app is sort of perfect? There's always sort of little improvements and stuff that can always be made. But it's good to sort of have a company that's at least listening and engaging on accessibility.
And when it comes to, let's look into the future now, something we always love doing on Tech Talk. You know, how would you like to see the world of smart speakers evolve in the future?
I think we all want really now, don't we, a sort of chat GPT or sort of Gemini integration. There are talks at the moment, obviously, about the sort of Amazon A-Lady Plus coming in. Initially, I believe that's just going to be on the speakers with a screen, but hopefully it will be rolled out to the Echoes as well, and possibly a subscription price to go with that. Unfortunately, like a lot of these things, it's all being rolled out in America first, so we're probably not going to get to look at it for a little while. But I think that's what we want, isn't it, really? Because the smart speakers have been great, but you would perhaps argue there hasn't been a lot of development in terms of what they can do, and the sort of detailed answers that they can give you perhaps hasn't been developed as much in the last few years.
And if people would like to find out more about smart speakers, whether it's demonstrations or whether it's just more information, is there any place that has a lot of information on a range of smart speakers?
I mean, obviously, there's plenty of information online. And again, I would just sort of go back to what I said earlier, depending on your sort of financial situation and your preference to audio quality and what you want, really. I did forget to mention a speaker that I have got earlier. It's a bit sort of higher price bracket, but it does have the Amazon A-Lady and Google, which runs simultaneously on there, which is quite rare. You can get speakers that sometimes you can sort of switch between the two, but this is the JBL Authentics range. You can have Amazon and Google on there at the same time, which I find sort of quite useful. You've got sort of two speakers in one there, or two smart assistants in one. But obviously, it is a sort of slightly higher price point. I think you sort of start in at, £250 for the 200 Authentics, I think it is.
That's quite fantastic. And I like how you mentioned the speaker that has both voice assistants running simultaneously, because it is rare, but that way, at least, you then have a choice of what you wish to use, and you don't have to kind of have 20 different speakers for, multiple assistants. You've got that one.
Yeah, they are very good. I think they've got three different speakers in their JBL Authentics range. One of them is a portable speaker. They call it portable. It's quite a hefty, but I think it's for sort of, you can carry it from room to room if you like. I think if you are sort of interested in that, that's definitely one worth checking out, because you can, like you say, you can have that on your desk. And maybe if you've got two speakers there before, you can just have the one.
Fantastic. Well, plenty of recommendations then, a bit of information about smart speakers. So what do you think about the smart speakers after you've heard this chat? Are you more likely to get one? If so, which one sounds good? Or do you still have questions? Or are you a smart speaker aficionado and do you want to share your opinions just like Elliot did? Well, we would love to hear from you, so do get in touch with us. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. But for now, Elliot Stonehill, accessibility consultant, thank you very much for chatting to us here on RNIB Tech Talk.
Thank you.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and we are with Harpo. Welcome in to RNIB Connect Radio. Harpo have been around a while. You make Braille devices, and you've got a new Braille pen. Why don't you just tell our listeners about that?
Yep, we have a Braille Pen 24, which is the slimmest version of Note Taker that you can find on the market currently, I believe. We have 24 cells here. The cells, Braille cells, are from DOT, so these are not KGS, and that's why we could make such a cute, small, and pocket-size device. You'll become also 24 cursor buttons, and the device can work as a terminal with your iPhone, iPad, or other Android phones, for example.
24 is an interesting choice because there are a lot of portable Braille displays out there, 18, 20, 32, I guess, is a bit larger. Was there a reason you went for 24 particularly?
Yeah, we made some research and we found that the customers wanted to have a pocket size note taker that is not with 12 or 14 cells, and they don't need to have 40, for example, to have in their pocket. And that's why we choose 24. That's the maximum that you can fit into this case. So,
okay, and I have the device in front of me. Are you able to just describe the dimensions? You said it's the thinnest Braille display, portable yep. Braille display. Do you have any dimensions, any measurements?
Yep. So the size is 154 millimeters yep. / 97 / 14. So it's really slim.
So it's 14 millimeters thick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what were the first two? You said
154.
Right.
So, millimeters. So 15 centimeters.
15 centimeters.
Yeah. It's the weight is like the iPhone. It's only 230.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it is the one of the slimmest Braille devices I've ever seen. Very lightweight as well. And you are featuring a Perkins-style Braille keyboard
yep.
For input, obviously. And then you've got, as you say, the 24 cells of Braille using the DOT technology. So the same pins that you get on devices like the Monarch and the DOT pad. These pins are quite low energy, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, definitely.
So you get great battery life with those.
Yeah, it should last about 15 hours, 15 up to 20. Yeah. It depends how you're using it.
And you've got those cursor routing buttons as well.
Yep.
And then at the front edge, there is the space bar. It's a kind of a split space bar. So I guess you can do different functions with each side of that. Yeah. And then on the very front edge, then we have some extra buttons. Do you want to just tell us what they do?
Okay, there is extra buttons. So on the sides, you have ears for your neck strap.
Yep.
There is a refresh sensor, which is a touch sensor. Not the button, but touch sensor to refresh the cells.
Right, okay.
There you have thumb keys as well
yep.
for navigation.
Yep.
Joystick in the middle.
Yeah.
What next? The power button here on the right side.
This is at the back now. So we've got the panning keys at the front, and there's a little kind of joystick as well there. And then around the back, at the back right, there's a power button. Yeah.
And then you have a switch for modes.
Yeah.
So the terminal mode and the note taker mode.
Yeah.
In the center here
yes.
is a silent mode on yeah. and off.
Right.
And then micro SD card and USB-C connection.
For charging.
For
right.
charging, yep. yeah.
And is this going to work with all the major screen readers?
Yep.
Yeah.
With all the majors, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so when you're using it in its local standalone mode, there's, you know, the usual things that you would expect, like notes, and there's a books app in there. So is that just for books on the micro SD card then?
Yep,
yeah.
On the micro SD card, yeah, you can store them books, make some notes,
yep.
Make the calendar.
Yeah. Okay.
And is this available in the UK?
It should be available in about 1-2 weeks because we are finishing the firmware software, but it's almost ready. So I believe when you are hearing this podcast, it's already available at Sight and Sound.
Sight and Sound in the UK.
Yep.
All right. And what are you expecting the price to be?
The recommended day price is about 2,000 euro.
2,000 euros.
Yeah, but it depends on the dealer. So I.
Yeah, but thereabouts. Yeah. Which for 24 cell. Portable, highly portable, very slim browser play. And then is there a case for this?
Yes, there is a case as well, with an extra, the USB-C cable, and the two additional frames for protection the cells.
And are they included, or do you have to buy those extra?
Yeah, they are included.
And I feel like we've covered everything. Is there anything I've not asked that we should have mentioned?
I think it's good to remember that there's the slimmest version note taker that you can find on the market. So
it really is. It really is. Yeah, very different type of device. And interesting to see the dot cells now in a single line display.
There's a lot of interest here.
Yeah. So this is the Braille Pen 24. And I guess you've got more information on your website.
Yep. BrailleBand.com.
BrailleBand.com. Wojtek with Harpo, thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio. That's all we've got for you this time here at Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. Remember, do tell a friend and stay in touch. It's the usual email address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. But from myself, Dave Williams, Jackie Brown, Natalie Curran, Hubert Pavalkovich and Callum Stoneman, bye for now.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.